Thank you so much for tuning in. This is the Psychology Is podcast. And the name of our podcast is based on the saying, where people are, psychology is. And my guest today is Dr. Sasha Reed. And I am very interested in the topic we're going to discuss, which is the psychology of serial killers. And in my experience as a professor, I have found that this is actually a fascinating topic for many, many people. Most students are extremely eager to learn about why serial killers become serial killers and what motivates them. And although it's such a disturbing phenomenon, it's one that we can't seem to look away from. So I'm very happy to have an expert with me today to dive deep into the psychology behind it. How are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. And thank you so much for having me on.
You're welcome. So I'll mention just a little bit about your background in case people don't know you. You are an interdisciplinary social science researcher, as you describe yourself, and I love that description. And the disciplines include developmental psychology, criminology, and law. I know that you received your PhD from the University of Toronto, worked as a professor at the University of Calgary, and then recently made the decision to go to law school. And so that will, I'm sure, give you a very unique combination of expertise. So congratulations on all that success and all your future endeavors.
I would not qualify that as success. It's like masochism, but thank you.
Right, that's true. So I have some topics I want to raise, and I'll just say that I first discovered you when I was watching the Netflix documentary series called The Unabomber, in his own words, and you were featured as an expert analyst in that documentary series. And then I started looking into more of the work that you have done and found your PhD thesis, and you're really garnering a lot of respect very early in your career. So I admire that.
Thank you. It's been a whirlwind existence. And to be honest, I find it extremely terrifying. Terrifying is the only word. Like, even my heart now is just pounding. Because I still feel so green, like so young and inexperienced in all of these fields, because I feel that there's still so much to learn. So it's nice to be able to get knowledge and awareness of, you know, what I'm studying out there, but it's so scary to be the face of that.
Understandable, you know, and honestly, your humility, I think, is actually reflective of your expertise. You know, many, many people who are listening even might even know about the Dunning-Kruger effect, which is this relationship between competence and confidence, where only a minimal amount of competence tends to exaggerate confidence, because it's almost like you know a little bit, but you don't know enough to know how much you don't know. And then as we continue developing our competence and becoming more knowledgeable, the confidence dips and we are humbled because we have this awareness of just how complex and vast a topic really is. So perhaps your humility is reflective of that expertise. So I want to start by reading just a little quote from the abstract of your thesis, which, as you say, the purpose of that was to trace the developmental mechanisms that come together to shape the lives and criminal trajectories of serial killers. And I'll read just the first few lines of that abstract to start our conversation. So you wrote that since the 1970s, scholars have produced a large body of research attempting to establish the mechanisms by which serial killers come to arrive at a life of repeat fatal violence. Traits such as psychopathy, biomarkers such as abnormal dopamine concentrations, and other developmental correlates such as early family environments have all been offered as proximal explanations for the motivation, psychopathology, and etiology of serial homicide. Unfortunately, however, from the standpoint of developmental psychology, these insights are far too limited in scope, you say. Human thought, functioning, and behavior are the product of complex reciprocal transactions that occur between the individual and their environment throughout the lifespan. So let's start with this question. It's a simplistic question, but it's the one that everyone always asks. So I'll start with it, which is, are serial killers born or made? So what do you usually say when people ask you that question?
So first, let me just say, I'm extremely relieved that your first question was not, are serial killers evil? Because the insertion of that term in anything regarding serial killers just drives me mental. And we can talk about the reasons for that. But I appreciate your question, born or made, because I think it's a simplistic question, but it's an important one. And it's one that you can kind of touch on, but then there's a whole series of events that you need to talk more deeply about. So the answer to that is, it's the most frustrating academic answer every academic gives, is both. Serial killers are both born and made, but I would lean a little bit more towards made. In terms of being born, you have to realize all of the biological, genetic, and epigenetic information that's already there by the time of preconception, right? And this is what I do as a developmental psychologist who's looking into lifespan trajectory. You're not just looking at conception until death. You're looking at generations that precede conception of a certain individual. And you're seeing how are epigenetic mechanisms, so environmental impacts, affecting genetics and then working their way into subsequent generations, right? So you have to consider all of that, which is kind of like the more, it's in there, it's in that genetic sequence, DNA of the individual. And then you're interacting with those environmental elements. So as usual, a combination.
Right. So it's fair to say then that there, those environmental factors, those situational factors and experiences that shape a person into a serial killer would not shape everybody into a serial killer. There has to be some existing predisposition that's kind of being awakened, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, and predisposition, I think, is also, as a developmental psychologist, a very difficult thing to wrap my head around, just because no one is predisposed to being a serial killer. No one on the planet is predisposed to being a serial killer. We are all predisposed to certain things, be it alcoholism or just addiction in general, violence. But there is no predisposition to serial homicide or even like homicide in general.
So what would you say there is, like you just said, you know, we're all predisposed to violence. Are there varying degrees to which we are predisposed to violence in your understanding?
In my understanding, I mean, violence, as much as we don't like to think about it or engage with it or really embrace it as part of us as a species, it's central. We are a human species. We did not get to the top, and I say top, like lightly, by just being like all loving, compassionate, hugging creatures. There's some violence that helped us to get here. So deep in our DNAs, there is the capacity for violence. Fortunately, we've kind of created these legal structures and these social structures and these psychological structures also that help us to refrain from that. We've learned to live more harmoniously. We're no longer in great competition with one another for our resources. So our predisposition to violence is like now very low, still there, but low.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So the biomarkers that you mentioned in that abstract quote I just read, what is your sense of the most consistent biological markers that serial killers have?
For serial killers, it's kind of difficult because there's been so few studies. We actually don't know a whole lot about what the biomarkers are for serial killers. And this is where my paper gets into a little bit more depth. Like when we talk about biomarkers, what is it that we're talking about? We're talking about norepinephrine, dopamine, serotonin. We're talking about these things. And research has shown us that certain levels that are out of flux can lead to antisocial behavior, gambling behavior, stuff like that. So for example, low dopamine, high serotonin. With low dopamine, you're always searching for that next high. You're looking for something that's going to bring those feel good things back up. So we do know that low dopamine, high serotonin is a part of this. However, those studies are really based on psychopaths. When we cannot, under any circumstance, conflate serial homicide with psychopathy, right? Not all serial killers are psychopaths. In fact, most aren't. And I think that's addressing misconceptions about serial homicide for me is one of the most important things, just because going into my dissertation in the first place, I had about 2 years knowledge about serial killers built in. And as I started studying, I had to start dismantling everything I knew, because everything was either just like a faulty study conducted with a group that should never have been compared. It was based on psychopaths, which, you know, is a population in and of themselves that have enormous neurobiological and neurotransmitter deficiencies, or like the definition didn't even make sense. So misconceptions are huge, and I think that's like a big thing when you're looking at serial homicide. So unfortunately, we really don't know what the big biomarkers are. People will say it's dopamine and serotonin, but that's based off of psychopathic samples.
Yeah, interesting. What you just said, I must say, is surprising and counterintuitive that most serial killers are not psychopaths. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So I think one of the things that I discovered most, and that was, I guess, the most frustrating when starting out on this journey of figuring out who serial killers are, was trying to truly figure out who they are outside of media conceptualizations and everything that we've been told ever. When you think of a psychopath, you think of somebody who's callous, manipulative, cruel, has the capacity for heinous violence, and you're not wrong. Some psychopaths are like that, but for the most part, you have to remember psychopathy is not defined on the basis of behavior. It's a disorder defined on the basis of affect, right? Or for an absence of affective features, lack of empathy, lack of guilt, lack of remorse. Antisocial personality disorder is, you know, more about those behaviors, not psychopathy. And yet we tend to equate psychopaths with people like Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer and Ed Kemper, and just like, no, just no, that's not correct at all. And because these people like Ted Bundy, for example, are kind of held as the pinnacle of what a psychopath would be, and they're a serial killer, you begin to equate the two, oh, psychopathy and serial homicide. No, like about maybe 30% of serial killers are psychopathic, like full on capable of being diagnosed as a psychopath. You've got a lot who are subclinical psychopaths, so people who have a lot of psychopathic traits but don't necessarily reach or even, you know, go over that diagnostic threshold. For the most part, what you see is a lot of paraphilias. Sadism is huge. You see a lot of addiction, a lot of depression. For me, those are the big ones.
Interesting. Paraphilias, sadism, addiction, depression. These are, I suppose you could say, some of the psychological markers of serial killers. So those other 70% in your estimate of serial killers who might not be diagnosable psychopaths, would you say that they actually do have affect and they do feel remorse?
And again, that's like another one of our misconceptions, is this view and belief that serial killers are able to inflict such atrocious violence that there's no way they can feel. They can. I mean, there's several instances of serial killers who were physically ill after committing their murders because they were so upset by what they had done. They were so frustrated by that feeling of compulsion that drives them to do what they do. Like, this entire view and belief that serial killers and psychopaths are one and the same is just completely wrong. And I think it also does a lot to stigmatize the entire population of psychopaths in general. Even the term itself is like really stigmatizing. Like I said, like serial killers, you will see psychopathy, right? You will. And that's probably even more than 30%. Maybe some people haven't even been diagnosed, right? So you always have to factor that in. But to say that they're all psychopaths is just laughable. It's completely wrong.
Interesting. So would you say that it's in, you know, in the same way, like I work with many people with severe drug addictions, and one thing that many of them will say is basically, I want to use, but I don't want to use, if that makes sense. It's like, I wish I didn't have this desire, but I do have this desire. And I've heard, for example, in an interview with Jeffrey Dahmer, talk about this just insatiable desire to possess men permanently was how he put it. And that, and I remember the interviewer asked him, do you like that you feel this way? And he was like, no, I definitely don't. And so it's hard to imagine that someone like Jeffrey Dahmer had any affect or empathy or ability to feel at all. But in that interview, there was signs of that, however faint. So is this kind of the idea here, that maybe it's a little bit more driven by just this sheer addiction and not necessarily absence of feeling?
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely not driven by an absence of feeling. I would say that serial homicide is driven by an overabundance of unmanageable emotion. It is an addiction. It is a compulsion. And the act of homicide inflicted by a serial killer is, in their imagination, a form of therapeutic release.
Yes.
And like, it's... people don't like hearing that because no one wants to hear about homicide as a form of therapy. And let's not normalize this. It's bad. But at the same time, if you're going to understand a population of people whose behavior is bizarre, whose thought patterns are bizarre, you have to engage with an openness to understand the world from where they're at. You can't just start with where you're at and all your moralizing and judgments and be like, well, that's incorrect. No, for a serial killer, the murders that they inflict, for the most part, are a form of therapy for them because there's an overabundance of emotion that they do not know how to deal with. In fact, it was really interesting. In my research, we were looking at where does this compulsive aspect and nature of the serial killer arise? Like, where is it located? And we came up with the concept or the term of what's called the bad man. And this is like two sides of the coin. There's like the serial killer who you see, who everyone's like, oh, I can't believe he did that. He was such a good guy. And then there's the other side of the serial killer, who's the more authentic him. It's the bad man. And that's the side of him that he doesn't really have control over, just like the addict you were speaking about. He doesn't have control over this person. It's not a dissociative identity disorder. They're very aware of this person. They're very connected and attached to that person. But that person comes out, the bad man comes out in instances when the serial killer is boiling over with emotions that they can no longer contain, when they feel that their life and their psychology is being risked, if there's a threat, the bad man comes out. And that's who helps to kind of bring things back to a homogeneous state.
Miss No, I want to read another part of your thesis, because you talk about this phenomenon of it being therapeutic in there, and you describe it as restorative psychology as a source of the motivation to kill. And I'll read another quote that I pulled. So you wrote that restorative psychology is a term to describe the peaceful Zen-like calm that overcomes the offenders just prior to and after the homicides. It is an entirely immersive, restful state that is experienced by these men in times that precede their homicidal violence. And for them, it is a feeling that enables these men to heal psychologically and emotionally from overpowering feelings of stress and emotional discontrol, similar to events experienced as children. And then a little bit later in the paper, you say, these individuals identified their emotions as stemming from discomforting feelings, thoughts, and emotions that were precisely linked back to childhood experiences of insecurity, emasculation, a lack of power, lack of control, and a lack of agency. It's fascinating. And yeah.
Like for me, that was, I think, the most exciting. There's several exciting parts of that research, but that was the most interesting. Not because you saw that there was a restoration, because I think in some spheres, that feeling of restorative psychology, what I termed it to be, is it's there. We kind of knew that, but we didn't know that it linked directly back to feelings of childhood events, feelings of helplessness, feelings of being jailed, ashamed, alone. Like, that was so fascinating. It was fascinating.
Yes. And one thing that comes to my mind is, you know, you may be aware, Dr. Reed, of this phenomenon, but I'll just describe it for watchers and listeners of insight. In social psychology, we talk about the out-group homogeneity bias, which is this tendency to perceive everyone in this group that I'm not a part of, this out-group, as being more similar to each other than they really are. And this sets the grounds for stereotyping people, because to stereotype a whole group, you first have to assume that they're all similar to each other. And I noticed that even in my own mind, I tend to have this out-group homogeneity bias for serial killers, and this assumption that they're pretty much all the same as each other, that their motivations and their psychological profiles are the same. But as I continue looking into it, I realize that there's actually some diversity within serial killers, which is interesting.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's one of the most interesting things as well. I mean, okay, let's just say right away, everything to me is interesting about this. This is the reason why I studied it for so long. But yeah, I mean, we have kind of been taught that serial killers embody this one type of person. Men in between the ages of 25 to 40, they're probably white, they're probably higher intelligence, and their motivations are probably sexual. It's like, that is the smallest slice of pie. Like, there are so many different types of serial killers with so many different types of motivations. There are both male and female serial killers. And I think this is one of the most fascinating aspects, their background experiences. We do kind of tend to imagine that because they can inflict such violence, they had to have been raised in homes. There had to have been abuse. There had to have been all of this maladaptive stuff that was going on. And it's also not true. Serial killers had very much a similar development as many of us. Like, they live along the bell curve. You had those at the high end, high socioeconomic status. Their parents gave them everything. And then you have those like Henry Lee Lucas, living in impoverishment with a mother who made him watch her have sex with random men. And then you have people living in the middle, where maybe there was some divorce, maybe there was some abuse, but nothing egregious. So, and like I said, like when I started writing my dissertation, the biggest thing was overcoming the fallacies of what we believe a serial killer to be. Because whatever we believe is probably for the most part not true.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. And when you, like, I'm trying to remember his name. I think he was called the Genesee River Killer. Arthur, I'm not remembering his last name, but
Shawcross?
Yes, Shawcross. Thank you. He, although some people are skeptical as to whether it was true because his mother denies it, he claims, and I actually believe him because of course his mother would deny this, that his mother was extremely abusive to him, especially in the sexual domain, that she would perform oral sex on him. She made him eventually have intercourse with her. She would shove things up his anus and just the most sickening imaginable abuse. And you have someone like that, and I'll just say quickly before I continue on with this point that when you learn about the past of serial killers like that, it's very interesting, at least for me, what it does to me emotionally, because my just rage and disgust with him transforms as I learn about his past. And then it's like there's this ingredient of compassion that gets mixed into the recipe of feelings toward him. It's really complex. But what I was going to say is you have someone like that, and then you have someone like Ted Bundy, who famously had a really safe, loving home, principled and structured, and there was virtually no trauma. And so I think this is just kind of speaking to that diversity within serial killers, that their childhoods don't always look the same. I imagine that's probably a much higher percentage compared to the average population of trauma, but it's not a given. It's not the only cause.
Yeah. Well, okay, let me kind of bring you into the journey of how this study unfolded, because for me, this is a really big thing. When I first started studying serial killers, I developed a database for I wasn't in my PhD. I was doing nothing. I was literally doing nothing. And I was like, oh, what a great thing to do. I'll start a database of serial killers. And you know, I was in my master's of child study and development. And I thought it was really interesting, all of the different things that could affect human development, like everything can affect human development. And I thought that was really interesting. And my focus has always been on serial killers. So let's make this database. And once I had got to a certain number of serial killers, maybe it was like, I don't know, at this time, we'll say around 200 serial killers for whom I had like 600 data points on, I thought, okay, I've got enough data to be able to run an analysis just to see like what's popping up most frequently. Like, am I going to confirm these beliefs that serial killers come from low SES backgrounds and are abused? And as I started going through these variables, I was getting more and more frustrated because I was like, absolutely nothing is the same across the board. Like nothing, like all of these years, and I found nothing. So my heart kind of broke a little because a lot of work went into that. There was not one thing that was similar for all serial killers. Like head injuries, some had them, some didn't. Parents divorced, some were, some weren't. Some were abused, some were not. It's like, oh my God, what's the thing? What's the one thing that makes a serial killer? And it was nothing. And even looking at the stats within the serial homicide database and comparing that to similar stats that we would see across non-homicidal databases, like the Cambridge Youth Study, for example, because it also looks at human development. Comparing the serial homicide database to Cambridge Youth Study, it's just like, there's some things that happen in serial killers more often than those kids, but not to a statistically significant degree. And even when you compare serial killers to non-serial killers, but like homicide offenders or just sexual offenders in general, the results are kind of mixed. Right? Serial killers are higher in some things, whereas like non-serial homicide offenders are higher in others. It's like, this is really frustrating.
Yeah.
And so going through all of that, I was like, okay, well, there's not one thing in this database that really leads me to believe that there's this, you know, magic pill for being a serial killer. What do I do? And at this point, I was in my PhD and I was like, okay, I'm taking a break from this heinous, horrible work. And I'm going to work at a prison, like, much more sunshine and rainbows. So I started working in a prison and I just wanted to get my dissertation out of my mind because it was horrible. And all I did for the course of 4 months was just talk to offenders of all sorts, men, women, gang members, rapists, domestic violence, people, everybody. And one of the most interesting and amazing things that I found was in the way they thought. So for example, I think I honest to God believe that this is something I learned in undergrad psych, but I forgot about it. But we were doing a group session with, I think it was 20 different offenders in the men's wing. And one of the questions we asked was, imagine you're downtown Toronto, just on a random bus in any section of the city. How many people out of 100 on that bus do you think have been to prison? And the average answer was 80%. I was like, what do you mean 80%? Like, this is, we're talking about prison. What do you mean 80%? So that was one thing that kind of really got me thinking, like, oh, that's just a really unique way that they're thinking, that 80% of people on a random bus in a random city would have gone to prison. And then we did the same thing in a women's unit. But instead of asking them that, we were asking them, what does it mean to be loved? What is the concept of love? And there was 20 women, and they kept coming back to the concept of respect. And they couldn't break out of it. What is love? Love is respect. What is respect? Respect is love. Just like, oh, what else? So at that moment, I was like, oh, the way they're thinking is just so weird. Like, it's not, I don't like saying weird because I don't want to stigmatize offenders at all. They have some insane experiences, but it's so much different from the way that I thought. So then I thought, okay, well, if these external behavioral and environmental and social aspects are not really leading me to believe that there's one that causes serial homicide, what if we bring in a little bit of qualitative analysis? What if we see how they think? What if we can understand how they think and then connect that to what they're experiencing? And that is where the curtains pulled wide open. You know, you were talking about Arthur Shawcross versus Ted Bundy, and you were saying, like, Ted Bundy never experienced any kind of trauma or abuse. And I find that really interesting because objectively, he really didn't. Like, he had a pretty benign childhood. But what we found when we started studying the way that serial killers thought was that trauma is everywhere. It doesn't matter if it was objective. The way they thought about an experience was traumatic. It was abusive. Am I rambling? Should I?
No. Please keep coming. This is fascinating.
And I have a really good example. I don't know if you've seen pictures online. They're like everywhere, but there's a picture of me in my office, and in behind me, there's a bunch of serial killers. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't for like media, whatever. It was because I was in the middle of a study looking at the qualitative content, the phenomenology of serial killers. And because we anonymized the names, so we couldn't actually see who it is that was talking, I couldn't tell two people apart, like person A from person B. I was like, they're the same person to me, completely, in the way they think, in the way they experience, they're the same person, but they're not, because there's an A and there's a B. So who are they? So I eventually had to put pictures up so I could tell them apart, like, oh, that's person A, that's person B. Person A was Ed Kemper, who did have a very maladaptive early childhood. He was really tall. His mom was like wildly inappropriately sexual with him in weird ways. She made him sleep in the basement because she was afraid that he was going to rape her daughters. And she's like, that's a very strange way to treat your son. And then person B was a Green River Killer. What's his name? I can't remember it. Gary Ridgway. And Gary Ridgway, again, like Ted Bundy, had a relatively benign childhood, but he had warped and twisted his mom's demands, requests to do something like homework, as being akin to him being in like a concentration camp where he was forced to do things, and he just experienced every interaction with her as completely traumatic. It's just unbelievable how similar these two saw the world in spite of having completely different developmental origins.
Yes.
Like, to the point where you literally couldn't tell them apart unless you were looking at them.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it was mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So if there's, you know, I suppose this is the closest you feel you've gotten to a common ground among serial killers, is in this way of thinking and in the perceived trauma of their past.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
There's a couple of directions I want to go with this, but the first I'll bring up is Ted Kaczynski. So I watched that whole Netflix documentary series twice, actually. which I was surprised at how much more I got out of it the second time around. So I might start doing that more with books and documentaries and stuff. But what I missed the first time and caught the second time was just how resentful he had become of other people and of society at large. And there's some specific examples from his past that you could say are kind of the origins of his resentment toward other people. And then in a moment, I also wanted to read the first paragraph of the Unabomber Manifesto. So I'll do that in a moment. But first, just to talk about his resentment toward people. So you talked about this torturous experiment that he was subjected to at Harvard University. Can you describe that for us to the degree that you know it? Because I know a lot of the details are concealed.
That's the hard part about talking about this project, because so much of it is concealed, and then so much of it is also hypothesized to be a part of a very covert study, which is MKUltra. So let's stay away from MKUltra, because that opens the door of conspiracy. But I mean, like, it's wicked cool, but like,
yes.
Yeah, fair. Talk about the actual experiment itself. So it was run by a guy by the name of Dr. Henry Murray, and he was interested in just looking at human development. I mean, if you go into the Harvard database, you'll see his interest in human development. All of his studies are looking at this. And he was looking at, you know, human intelligence, human creativity, ingenuity. And Ted Kaczynski was just one person who was a part of this. There were several people. It was a very long, drawn out study that asked the participants, like Ted Kaczynski, to write about themselves. Who are you? Right? What are you all about? What's your philosophical position on this? What are your political ideologies and why? And you have to understand that Ted is this person who his entire life had been looking to find somebody who was at his level, right, of intelligence. And he found kind of a father figure in Henry Murray. And so he experienced enormous joy in being able to talk about these ideas on an intellectual level that he just couldn't with his mom and his brother David. And so he experiences a lot of joy. He's finding some kind of kinship, a family almost, with Dr. Murray. And then the other part of the study begins. And that's in dismantling a human being on the basis of everything that they held dear. Oh, your political beliefs are stupid because you're intellectually inferior because, and there was real, like really no reality to this at all. And Ted picks up on that a lot in his conversations and his back and forths between a person who's like, oh, you know, your political ideologies are, you know, they're flawed because of this. And Ted's like, what do you mean? Like, your arguments don't even have a grain of truth.
Right.
And then, you know, that back and forth keeps going. And then it kind of just wrapped up. It kind of ended and closed, so far as we know. That kinship, that familial relationship that Ted thought he had with Dr. Murray crumbled, like was like obliterated essentially.
And the goal of the study was to attempt to just see if he was resilient or break him down. What's your understanding of what the purpose of that was?
That's the more complex aspect of this study. If you are of the belief that it was part of MKUltra, it was part of a project to see how we could break human beings and build them back up, which is where I stand.
Yeah.
If you're of the belief that it was just a random regular study, it was just that. You're just trying to figure out the resilience of other people. Okay. But, yeah.
And the effect that it had on Ted Kaczynski, because in the documentary, they play some clips of the conversation. But and in that, he's kind of holding his ground and he's saying, like you said, you know, you're just labeling my positions. You're not actually arguing them logically. But still, even though that is portrayed as him kind of holding his ground and being strong, like his brother said, that was, it was very harmful on him. And he was only 16 or 17 at the time, yeah. You know, so he's, as people may know, Ted Kaczynski's the Unabomber. He, you know, crafted bombs in this little secluded home in the woods, and those bombs got increasingly effective, and he sent them through the mail in this hidden packaging and killed people and caused a lot of harm. And he's still alive, right? And in prison.
Oh, he's still alive.
Yeah. So, and he, to me, just a side note too, he's a prime example of something that, you know, we often say when we talk about intelligence, which is that intelligence is morally neutral, that just because you're highly intelligent, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have goodwill. And he's a prime example of that. And the thing about being highly intelligent is that you're more effective at whatever you do. So whatever your intentions are amplified. And so if they're bad intentions, unfortunately, you can cause a lot of damage and harm in the world. And he's a prime example of that.
Absolutely.
And then you also talked about his kind of moment where he was contemplating a sex change, went to see a psychiatrist, and ultimately came away feeling ashamed, enraged, and humiliated. I understand there was also a relationship he had with a woman. He was very inexperienced romantically and sexually, but he had a relationship with a woman. She kissed him, kind of really stole his heart, but then ended up telling him that she just wanted to be friends. And those were like the three things that were really highlighted as the sources of his resentment toward other people. And then, if I may, I'll read the first paragraph of the Unabomber Manifesto, which I recommend people look that up and read it. It's like a 38-page document, and it's fascinating. And here's how it starts. He says, "The Industrial Revolution and its consequences have been a disaster for the human race. They have greatly increased the life expectancy of those who live in the, quote, advanced countries, but they have destabilized society, made life unfulfilling, have subjected human beings to indignities, have led to widespread psychological suffering, and have inflicted severe damage on the natural world. The continued development of technology will worsen this situation. It will certainly subject human beings to greater indignities and inflict greater damage on the natural world. It will probably lead to great social disruption and psychological suffering, and it may lead to increased physical suffering, even in these, quote, advanced countries." And then he goes on to analyze very critically and thoroughly the structure of society and what the industrial and technological revolutions are doing to society. And so that was his outlook on society. And, you know, he was an advocate for basically doing away with technology and just accepting the consequences of that, because they'll be better than continuing on with it. And I think when people read this, it resonates with many people. And especially at that time, like the hippie movement, it was seriously resonant with that movement. And it's kind of like the Dexter effect, where someone's killing people, but you kind of can get on board with why they're targeting, in some cases with Kaczynski, people who are actually doing harm in the world. So it's fascinating.
I mean, I have a lot of thoughts, and I'll never say opinions, but hypotheses about Kaczynski. He's such an interesting person to me. I think from what I've read, because there's not just his manifesto, right? There's also his longitudinal diary, which is just thousands of pages prior to him becoming the Unabomber. And having read both, I really do question whether or not he would be okay if technology just vanished. I really, and I mean, even in his early diaries, he does say, "I'm killing people because I'm angry." Mm. Like, he needs to find a justification, because he is an intelligent person and he doesn't want to come off as this random thug. Like, his first attempted homicide, he was just going to stab a woman. But he's like, "Oh, that's so base. Like, look at me with my high IQ. I can do better." So I really think that Kaczynski holds these beliefs, but I think that his honest belief in those values grew the more he got attention from holding those values. Like that is not what started it. It is not. And he explains that in his diary. But also, and just back to Henry Murray's study, I think that's just a really good example of the way in which differences in human perception can lead to problematic outcomes or not. Like Kaczynski was not the only person in this study, but he was the only one who became the Unabomber. And it's because when you look at all of the developmental antecedents and his thought patterns prior to this study, he should never have been involved. He was a high risk person for not violence, but severe maladaptation as a result. Everyone else was okay. Like they didn't have Kaczynski's thought patterns. But Ted, his youth, his thought patterns, his development, everything said this was a high-risk person.
How close are we to identifying high-risk people?
I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about this, but I will at like arm's length. So currently, part of what I'm doing is looking to identify at-risk people for things like terrorism, extremist violence, hate-based crimes, incel terrorism, stuff like that. We are getting very close. We're not at that minority report style
knowledge yet.
Like I'm personally afraid of us getting to that point, but we're not at that point yet. I think with quantum computers, we will get to that point. I'm concerned that we will, but yeah. I do think we're close.
And what do we do as that develops, as we are better and better at identifying high-risk people? What do we do with that knowledge?
That's the big question. That's like the big philosophical question. And you can't answer this as a psychologist or a law enforcement agent or an actor in the justice system. You can't answer it as one person. This is why I love transdisciplinarism, because you have to be part of everything.
Yes.
This is a question, and this is an action that will hit at the core of all of humanity. Like we as a human population need to have a discussion about predictive policing. We need to have a discussion about privacy rights and what the government is able to scrape from the internet. Like these are big questions.
Yes.
Because we are getting to that point of prediction, and there's enormous consequences. Locking somebody up because they're predictive pattern says that they're going to act. What about false positives? What about false negatives? These are massive questions of the day. And unfortunately, we're very close.
Yeah. Do you have, I know you've thought about it a lot, but do you feel like your thoughts have crystallized around that to any degree? Like if we just create a sort of hypothetical example of someone who's scoring as high as possible on this predictive measure, is there, in your view, is there any ethical basis of taking any action toward limiting their influence in their life?
I am very on the fence about this because there's two sides of me, just like any person. There's a side of me that's the psychologist and who's always like, let's test the boundaries, let's see. And then there's a part of me who's the lawyer who's like, stop right there. We've got the Constitution. So let's have a little thought experiment from both sides. As a psychologist, let's say I just put my morality aside and I'm approaching things as a pure intellectual thought experiment. What's happening? We know this person. We've identified this person online. We know that they are very high risk. We can monitor all we want. There's already some privacy issues there, but sure. Mm-hmm. If we stop them from doing what it is that they're believed to do, we have the potential of saving thousands of lives, which is a good thing. But how do we stop that person and at what point in time? Do we lock them up without any actual crime having happened? How do we justify this? Like, and I know there's a difference between like actus reus and mens rea. I get that, like the crime and the thought, but how do you prove that a person was going to do this? people can say all sorts of things and you can be high risk and not actually go ahead and do anything. Right. And we see that. Like, I'm seeing that in the analyses that I'm doing on content that I'm analyzing right now. There are people who show up as extremely high risk and who for decades have done nothing.
Fascinating.
It's scary because then you get to the point of, can we lock people up for having certain thoughts and communicating that? And then we just go, like, that's too scary for me. Like, as a lawyer, that's just not acceptable. You can't lock people up for that. Curious.
Kind of on this note of thoughts, one of the things you've talked about is the way that serial killers have these sort of two lives in a way where they have their sort of social presentable self and then this fantasy life. And as you've described it, that's more authentic to them, is that fantasy life. And this is something that indeed I've heard in various interviews I've heard of serial killers. They talk about this a lot, the way they fantasize. And then it seems that it gets so intense that they just have to act on it. So can you talk about the fantasy life of serial killers?
Yeah. So serial killers are unique in that a great deal, and again, let's not generalize, this is not all, but the sample that I looked at, they were raised in such a way that they had no other option for self-soothing other than drawing inward, right? They did not have good connections with their families, or parents, their aunts and uncles. They were they always felt alone. And just I know this is going to be tangential, but hold on a second.
I'm with you.
I studied serial killers from a phenomenological standpoint, and phenomenologists do not recognize a substantive difference between objective and subjective experience. The only reality is in how people experience that and give meaning to that, right? So when I say that serial killers did not have a meaningful relationship with their parents, it's not that their parents didn't try, like Ted Bundy. It's not that it didn't look like there was. It's that the serial killers truly, honestly felt alone in that early relationship with their parents. They did not feel understood. And if they were loved, they didn't feel loved the way that they wanted to be. And so they're alone. Internally, they're just very alone. And then they try different things here and there. They go to school, they try to make friends, and they're rejected for the most part. 70% actually were actively rejected from peer groups. 70% actively rejected. The other 30% honestly believed that the friend group that they had didn't love them. Didn't like them at all. So again, the objective, subjective, doesn't matter.
Right.
So again, even within the context of social relationships outside their families, they feel alone. So they pull inward in order to cope and self-soothe and make meaning and give meaning to their life. And because they feel so let down by society, so let down by their families, they do start to tell themselves stories, just like any person would. You tell yourself a story to make yourself feel good. And their story, because they lack it, is one of power and control. In my kingdom, in my world, in my fantasy realm, I am the one who everybody looks at, and I am the one with the power. I determine life and death because I can. So they build this grandiose narrative of who they are and what they're capable of. And they need that, because they lack that objectively or subjectively in the real world. And as it grows and as it develops, they go a little more extreme, just like an addict, right? You start with, one little bump of cocaine, but that's not enough. Throughout the night, you're gonna need like 10. So it starts off, oh, that was a really good thought or fantasy. I had the control and I, did whatever. But the more they think about it, and we're not talking weeks, we're talking decades, the more they live in that fantasy of the world, the more they cope and resort to coping in that world, the further they need to push their capacity to exert power and control. And because of the built-up resentment of not being able to fit in anywhere, of being bullied, of being rejected, of feeling isolated, their thoughts and their need for power and control get violent. Mm. And that is the one thing that makes them feel safe. I had a bad day at work today. Let me just like sit back and reflect on how powerful I am in my world. Let me draw, let me journal. And they do. Mm. And at one point, and we do see this in the database that I have, you do see there is a precipitating moment in the life of a serial killer where all of this comes to a head, where they're like, I cannot be a passive actor in the world anymore. I have to exert my power, my built up fantasy power. And that's when they actually engage in homicide. Mm. Like, they live in it because they need it. It becomes violent because there's no compassion when no one's giving it to you. That's what it is.
Mm. Excellent explanation of that. Ted Bundy described it as a jumping off point when the fantasy was no longer satisfying enough. Like your analogy of drug tolerance is really perfect, you know, and with people who know drugs know that the same amount of the drug, you become desensitized, right? You need more and more and more of it. And then eventually you might even need like to go from cocaine to methamphetamine or something much more significant, which I suppose is kind of like the jumping off point from fantasy to acting out. And in fact, I wanted to read this quote too, and then we'll kind of tie it back to what we're talking about. But in Ted Bundy's last interview before he was executed, he said, I've lived in prison for a long time now, and I've met a lot of men who are motivated to commit violence just like me. And without exception, he said, every one of them was deeply involved in pornography. Without question, without exception, deeply influenced by and consumed by an addiction to pornography. And he described the process of that addiction exactly in the way we're talking about, with tolerance increasing to the point where the same old, you know, whatever, violent sexual pornographic scene is not as thrilling. So you need more intensity. And then there's only so far that a fantasy can take a person when their tolerance is that high. And that's the jumping off point where for him, he said, that was when he started contemplating, I wonder what it would be like to actually do this. And what comes to my mind too, as I think about the way serial killers have such a vivid fantasy life, is the way that it's almost like a virtual reality. Some people's fantasy lives are so vivid that it's like a virtual reality experience, initiating chemical reactions in the body to go with it. So yeah, wow.
There's a concept, and oh my God, I know I'm gonna forget the name. People can Google it. I think it's like the illusory truth paradigm. It's like when you repeat something so often, it becomes true. Like it's a total lie, but it becomes true. But it's almost like that with serial killers. Like they do acknowledge initially that fantasy life that they're living in is like just a fantasy. But the more they're in it, the more they're in it. Like it becomes not so much of a place that they retreat to in order to get better. It's a place that they live. It's a like an actual place in their mind. And again, this is not dissociative identity disorder, so let's try really hard to separate the two. But it is a place that they live in order to exist in the world. Yeah. It's as tangible and as real to them as like something like VR would be to us, or as real as this is to us. Mm-hmm. It does take them a second to pull out from that for a second. Like, and you do see it. People like victims who've escaped have seen it. Family members who have interacted with them and interrupted them for a brief minute have seen it. There is like an active pulling out process. They are entranced.
Yes.
It's fascinating. Hmm.
So I want to talk about like maybe three more major things along with whatever else comes up. But I do want to ask your views and understanding of the role of pornography. And then I also want to ask about celebrating serial killers and media portrayal of serial killers. And then I want to ask about the potential to minimize serial homicide. So to the first question, what's your, you know, in your analysis of the literature and in your databases and everything you know, what's the role of pornography in all of this?
Honestly, I think the reason why we know pornography and serial homicide is Ted Bundy. And I'm going to give the most academic response, and it's like to each his own. Mm-hmm. Pornography is not going to create a serial killer. Right. It doesn't do that. There's all sorts of harms that come out of pornography, like anti-woman, heinous rape, nonsense. There's people with sex addictions who pornography just really harms. But there's also a good side to pornography, right? It can be fine, right. But to each his own, right? For some people, it becomes an excuse that they can latch onto. This did it to me. It's not me. It's not my fault. It's not my lack of insight or ability to get help. It's pornography. It's like, but is it? Is it really? No. So, I mean, in general, pornography has pros and cons. It is what it is. For some people, it does become the external thing that they wrap their guilt around because they can't use the insight. Like, they don't have insight. Like Ted Bundy said, like, he's going to die not knowing why he did what he did. Mm-hmm. He thinks it's pornography, but it's not. Right. It's just an excuse.
That makes sense. Yeah. And it's a good point that pornography is not just one thing. There's a fundamental difference between watching two people have sex and, you know, it's super sexy and arousing versus watching someone get assaulted and raped and violent sex. So those are fundamentally different, you know, and the vicarious element, I think, which is part of what draws people to pornography, the ability to just literally almost imagine like that's me in that scene. There's a way different effect on the person who's watching two people have consensual sex versus the person who's watching two, you know, someone violently rape somebody.
Yeah. So, like you see a lot of victim blaming within the serial homicide population, like, oh, sex workers, they're evil, gross, you know, vectors of disease. They're not. They're people who are earning a living that way. Like, yeah. That's it. Yeah. But because they're perceived socially and within the mind of people as being horrible people, it gives them an excuse. It's a justification. She shouldn't have been walking at night. He shouldn't have been a bad husband. That patient in that hospital shouldn't have yelled at me. Like, there's always something to blame a victim on. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, it really is. And here's where I kind of diverge. You do need to have some insight into who you are and why it is that you do what you do. But through all of my research, serial killers have been failed at every single level. They have fallen through every crack, every single opportunity there was to help them gain insight and to grow did not happen. Like, this is the outcome of failing people to an extreme degree. Mm-hmm. Like, these people were failed. So I understand their lack of ability to use insight. I'm frustrated. I'm so frustrated by it. But let's never, ever victim blame.
Right. Okay. So jump into that next question I alluded to. I recently had a conversation on this podcast with a man named Scott Bond, who is also, you know, a serial killer expert, I suppose, but specifically he is an expert in why people are so interested in serial killers. And he wrote a book called Why We Love Serial Killers. And he's got an interesting perspective because he was an NBC executive. So he's been on the media side of things and he saw with his own eyes and made decisions based on how profitable running stories on serial killers on NBC really is. And so that was just, you know, that was a recent conversation. So it has had me thinking about media portrayal of serial killers and the way that, you know, even how almost every serial killer gets a nickname, the Unabomber, the Night Stalker. that, and so I'm curious about your view on, are we celebrating serial killers too much, or is that detrimental, the way we portray them in media, or what are your thoughts on this?
I feel like the most academic person of all time, because I'm going to say there's pros and cons. Let me just like first start off and say I loathe to an extreme degree the celebration of serial homicide. Like, there's serial killer memorabilia, there's playing cards, there's people who get tattoos of serial killers. And, you know, if your listeners are one, you know, whatever, like, it is what it is, people do what they do. But I fundamentally believe that our focus on sensationalizing serial killers, giving them nicknames and covering only the most heinous, because, you know, there's a lot of serial killers who aren't covered, and that's a good thing, but the more heinous, the better, the more it's covered, we're doing an enormous harm to our society. We're doing an enormous harm to the family of the victims. And we're just, what happened to us? Like, what happened to allowing something like compassion and the good of humanity being front and center? Why is it that if it bleeds, it leads? And I understand that, like, we have this voyeuristic need to kind of engage and embrace our old, you know, tribal violence. Like, I really do believe that a lot of this is us trying to engage in a way with our old ancestral need for violence. But damn, like, it doesn't have to be everywhere. We don't need these documentaries. We don't need these shows. We don't need news coverage. I think it's really harmful because it gives killers an excuse, like everything else. It gives them an excuse to do what they do. I want to be celebrated. And you see that a lot with mass murderers. Like, I want to be celebrated. Right. And that's just grotesque. In fact, there's a bunch of academics, researchers, law enforcement, judges who've signed a document stating to the media, please don't publish the names. Please don't publish the names. It just feeds into this grotesque need to be seen, need to be validated on the part of the offender. But I also think it's like deeply harmful to the human psyche. Like, we're living in this suck fest world of COVID and not being able to see family and like social media and thinking that you're no good because, I don't know, a Kardashian looks better than you. It's just like, can we please focus on something good?
Right.
I think it just brings more sadness to the world. And maybe that's just like me trying to hope and like hold on to something good in this world, but I don't need to see any more of it. Like,
yeah, understandable. Absolutely understandable. And I agree that the impact on the human, like, I'll just be transparent. Like, last night, right, just thinking about this conversation, watched like 5 different interviews with different serial killers. And I was just lying in bed, eyes wide open, like kind of anxious. And like, I was hearing little sounds in the house and I was just a little more jumpy than usual. And I just saw this direct effect of my exposure to that type of content and the way that it affected my nervous system. It was not beneficial at all.
It really makes people believe that they're living in a dangerous world. And all evidence points to the contrary. This is the safest it's ever been, minus COVID.
Right.
But like, the world is not that dangerous. People are not fundamentally bad. In fact, as a person whose entire life focuses on the study of evil, I would have to say that the vast majority of people are wonderful, kind, generous, compassionate, thoughtful people. So it really does trick us into thinking we're living in this scary world, and we're not. I mean, it sucks, but it's not scary because we're going to get killed.
Right.
But now the other side of that, the flip side of that, is a lot of the research that I do wouldn't have been possible unless that stuff was out there in the public. Academics by and large believe that studying serial homicides is just a waste of time. It's like a pop media thing. And so they don't do studies. They don't go and do FOIAs. They're not doing freedom of information, anything. And I don't have to do a lot of that because it's already out there in the media. And I love that. You have to be extremely cautious about what you're using. And you do have to cross-validate your sources. But I'm thankful for the fact that that information exists so that I can make a database to make change and to better understand. But like, oh my God, I just can't anymore with the horrors of the world. No.
Yeah. And I suppose it's just, I think it's becoming increasingly important to consume media and information very selectively and consciously. And I think technology is allowing for us to be more selective with it. We're not simply, you know, having to just take in whatever's on the channel 8 like it used to be. It's now like you can be very selective with what you seek out in terms of the information and stories that you hear about. So I suppose
that's there's pros and cons with that, because then you get echo chambers and
back. Good point. Good point. You're right. So how about when it comes to minimizing the incidence of serial homicide? What's the path forward?
This is exceptionally difficult.
Right.
It's difficult because we start now getting into the realm of predictive policing and Minority Report. We will, within my lifetime, get to the point where we're able to predict with some degree of certainty whether or not a person's going to be at high risk for repeat fatal violence. You can see it. You can see it in the way that they write. You can see it in the development. You can see it in their interactions with people. You can see the developmental unfolding of serial killers. And so we can use that developmental unfolding to create risk assessment. Do we want to do that? False positives could result in life-changing trauma and the destruction of families. It really could.
Right.
Being able to identify and prevent is great. It could also result in, you know, saving an individual and saving an entire family or families from trauma. So it's like you're really stuck between a rock and a hard place. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we need to have a societal discussion of where we want to go with the vast amount of information that we have. Mm-hmm. Do we want Minority Report, or do we just want to risk it? What do we do?
Right.
But to that, though, I'd also say, like, there is no, under no circumstance, is there one developmental pathway for serial homicide. Mm-hmm. There's no way that even with every single risk factor, a person is determined to be a serial killer. Like, as a developmental psychologist, I cannot say under any circumstance that there's a thing known as determinism that doesn't exist. Mm. So I kind of err towards the side of just not having it. Don't try. What we can do in a way that I think is ethical, it's probably not going to be as effective as this, but also not as socially harmful as this. We can improve supports. We can provide more education within the prison system. We can implement true rehabilitation within the prison. And I'm not talking you get to go to like 13 classes and pretend that you learned something. No, like we really do need to start for serial killers or those who look to have certain risk factors. We need to start exceptionally early. You can see it between the ages of like 5 to 7. It's there. So we need to be able to get them at those early developmental points and say, sweet child, something's wrong. What is it that you need? Right? Every kid will be different. But then that's so hard because you've got all of these different experiences, right? You're going to be looking, if traditionally you're going to be looking at, oh, are they experiencing abuse? Are they lashing out? Some serial killers don't have that or do that. I have no idea what to do.
Yeah, I mean, that's honest. That's honest. And I think what you've said is in the same way that there's not a single source of this, there's not going to be a single solution to it. So I think you've spoken to it very intelligently, and I don't think anyone has the answer. I'd certainly, you know, when just thinking of like one of the many factors in the mosaic of preventing serial homicide or minimizing it is just the isolation. People's isolation seems to be a serious problem. You know, like you described, the way that serial killers from an early age learn to recede inward and kind of live in their own isolated fantasy world. So I suppose that if we as a society or more local social structures promote connection, belongingness, togetherness, that maybe it would curb the trajectory in certain people.
I'm really hoping.
Yeah.
Like, I honestly believe that's the only thing you can do, but then you're talking about turning over, upsetting an entire society that's become too focused on me.
Right.
Like, now you have to focus on others and compassion.
Right. Yes.
Very hard.
Yeah, very hard indeed. So as maybe, you know, a last question, you spoke to this a little bit just a few minutes ago, but how has all of this research and your immersion in this topic affected you personally?
I don't believe that I've been affected in a negative way, and I'll explain why. The reason why I started studying serial homicide in the first place was because as a child, I came face to face with a psychopath who literally tore my family apart. And as a 12-year-old, I couldn't make sense of what was happening. Monsters to me at that age were still werewolves and vampires. I didn't know that people could also be monsters. And so it was the most traumatic experience of my entire life. But because of that, I threw myself into the study of human monsters. I don't like using that term, but in relation to that, I will. I threw myself into the study of serial killers and psychopaths and deviants in general so that it could make sense to the trauma that happened to me as a kid. And in finding an answer to that, in knowing that evil does not exist and that there is explanations for why people do horrible things, I feel free. I feel fixed. I feel okay. I feel better, like healed. A lot of what I read is exceptionally horrible and morbid, but I look at it now from two perspectives. One is exceptionally detached. So for example, if I'm coding a manifesto of a mass killer, I'm looking at it as if I'm looking at a string of numbers. Mm. Like that's how much of an impact it has. It is nothing. Mm. And if I can't break out of that, I focus instead on how important the why is to people. And then I read that horrible, horrible stuff, knowing that maybe, just maybe, I'll help somebody else find the why to an experience that was traumatic. And that's okay. That's worth like the pain that comes with it.
Beautiful. Wow, beautiful. Well, this has been extremely enjoyable.
I hope I answered all your questions.
Yeah. And I appreciate your willingness to say, I don't know, and to not think that. I just think often experts of anything are put into a position where they have to come up with an answer and they avoid I don't knows. But in every topic, there's always more to know. There's always some level of mystery, and perhaps particularly with this topic. So I appreciate that humility, the acknowledgement of how much we still don't know and how complex this really is. And yeah, I certainly feel like some of my misconceptions have been just addressed here. So I appreciate that very much. And I fully trust that everyone listening has enjoyed this as much as I have. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Reed.
Yeah, thank you so much for giving me a space to talk about this stuff.
You're welcome. Well, is there anything you'd like to kind of plug, or is there a way that people can connect with you or dive farther into your work?
I have nothing to plug. I'm always embarrassed of everything I do. It's like, stay away from me. But like, I've got amazing research assistants who do the greatest stuff in the world. And I'll always plug my research assistants because they're just like the heart and soul of my work. So if you're interested in like looking at death in a positive way, what does it mean to die a positive death? I highly encourage you to reach out to Cassandra Geisel. She's got an Instagram. It's called Light in Death. She's just beautiful take on a positive death. And then Florence Tang, she can be found on TikTok and she does short segments on psychopathy. So follow my girls.
Awesome.
Stay away from me.
that's so humble. But cool. Thank you for making people aware, because yeah, we definitely cover like a very wide variety of topics on this podcast. So people's interests, I'm sure, are all over the place. Like, for example, we talked to that guy, Scott Bond, that I told you about. Why do we love serial killers? We're talking to you about the psychology of serial killers. And in between that, we talked to a baby psychologist about what makes babies laugh.
Who is this?
His name's Casper Adiman.
Oh, cool.
He lives in the UK. Yeah, and he's done great research on understanding what makes babies laugh. So yeah, the whole spectrum, like psychology is all pervasive, right? Where people are, psychology is. So there's really no topic that's off limits. And so I'm glad you brought those up.
Yeah.
That's perfect. Well, thanks to everyone who's still listening. And thanks again to you, Dr. Reed.
Thank you.